Good morning. I would like to call the House Education Committee to order. Today is March 20th, and let the record reflect the time is 8:01 a.m. Today we have present Representative McKay, Representative Prox, Representative McCormick, Representative Himshute, Representative Story, my co-chair, Representative Allard, and myself, co-chair Ruffridge. And we do have a quorum to conduct business. As per usual, I would like to remind the committee members, as well as those in the audience, to silence or turn off your cell phones. The staff assisting us today are Linda with House Records. Thank you, Linda. And Jake with the LIO. Joining me behind the desk today is my chief of staff, Bud Sexton. If you have any needs, just flag him down. Today, we are going to be hearing House Bill 69 and House Bill 9 for the third hearing, and it is my intent to move House Bill 69 from committee as well as House Bill 9. Today we will also have the first hearing for House Bill 10, which we will hear and set aside. Any comments or questions from committee members before we begin? Welcome. It's Monday. All right. Representative Kronk. I'm going to start with House Bill 69. Any questions from committee members for Representative Kronk, bill sponsor? Want us to give us a quick introduction and so thank we remember where we're at today.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Mike Kronk, District 36. This is HB 69. Basically, what this bill does is allows a first-class city to reclassify as a second-class city if the people choose so. And the purpose of this is to allow the transfer of Tanana City School to move into the Yukon-Kaiakuk School District.
Thank you, Representative Kronk. Any questions for the bill sponsor before we open public testimony? All right, seeing none. Oh, did you have a question? No. I will open public testimony. And is there anyone in the room wishing to testify on House Bill 69? Okay. Seeing none. Anybody online wishing to testify for House Bill 69? Also seeing none, I will close public testimony. It's back before the committee. Any questions, comments from committee members? Representative Story.
Thank you, Co-Chair Ruffridge. Just wanted to say that I really appreciate hearing from the superintendent in that area and how that has been thoroughly discussed among school board members, and that the districts basically have been working around those parameters for a while. And so that really helps me to think it's the right thing to do. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Story. Representative Prox.
Yes, thank you. Through the chair, I didn't see a fiscal note from the Department of Education. And I guess I'm wondering, I suppose the city was not making the required local contribution in the first place. I'm not sure whether actually they were required. Do you know whether this is going to translate into any more money going towards that school?
Thank you, Dave Stancliffe. Staff to represent Kronk for the chair. We've received the sheet from the Yukon-Koyukuk School District, and on that sheet it talks about the savings that will be achieved in combining the school districts and the duplication that won't occur. So we're anticipating a positive fiscal impact in a couple of different areas. There would be nothing in this bill that would suggest there would be a negative fiscal impact whatsoever. I'm assuming the Department of Education has looked at it that way. They've not provided anything to give this committee an indication that there'd be any type of fiscal note.
Follow up.
Well, just a comment. I guess it would be interesting to know. If the Fairbanks North Star Borough, which is a little larger, I guess, but they are required to pay a required local contribution of 2.6 mils. and that's taken off of the base student allocation that goes to that district, that school district. And I'm wondering if the same would have applied to the city of Tanana.
Through the chair, without revealing a lot of the sticky and maybe more controversial things that the city of Tanana is going through right now internally with their local government, I don't know if it would be productive to get into that, but I believe that what you're saying is exactly true. I believe that there probably has been a difficulty in meeting some of those requirements now that the population has dropped by almost 50%. We can certainly have the Department of Education and in Community Regional Affairs, this may come up as well, provide you some sort of further explanation, Representative Prox.
Mm-hmm. I think it would be interesting to know and think about, because we don't know how many other cities, small municipalities are facing the same issue only 10, 15 years from now.
Any other comments or questions for the bill sponsor, Representative Hemshue?
Thank you. Through the chair, on the face of it, this seems like we might be going in a really good direction, especially for Tanana, especially with the letter that we received. I'm troubled by the lack of input. I'd like to be hearing from council members in Tanana. I'd like to be hearing from the department. This feels like kind of a big thing to absorb one district into another district. And I'd like to hear from more than just the superintendent on that. So I'm not necessarily opposed to this. I just feel like I haven't heard enough from the local people about the need to do this.
Go ahead.
Thank you. Through the chair there. We 2 years ago, we reached out. When I first was elected, the community of Tanana reached out and at the time, they're defunct as a city, and all of them realize that they have, you know, when you're a one city show in a very small community, every decision you make is very impactful and it hurts people. So their whole purpose of let's go into the YK school district, we get a school board member on the regional school board, and the local politics play out of it. So I think when you find out when they do this, you know, basically do the survey of reclassifying that, you'll see that majority of everybody in Tanana knows this is the best path forward for them. And, you know, I apologize for no one testifying, but Kerry Boyd, the superintendent of YKSD, they've been already working with Tanana on a contract. So they've already been functioning as the school's, you know, lead for the past few years.
Thank you, Representative Kronk. Representative Allard.
Thank you. And through the chair, Representative Kronk, this legislation is an option. Is that correct? Meaning that you're just providing the legal means for them to have an option, and then at the end of the day, is it the city gets to make the decision?
Through the chair, Representative Allard, you are correct. This allows the people of Tanana to decide whether they want to declassify as a first class city to a second class city. And then if that happens through the commission, boundary commission, then they would have the option. So it's an option. Gives them opportunity.
Yes.
Through the chair, Representative Hemshue, there is a letter from both the mayor and a resolution from, and it's on your electronic file. I was just notified. I wondered if you hadn't got it, but I know that we sent it out. So there is a resolution from the council. There is a support from the mayor as well as the school district. And I appreciate your needing to know all that. So.
Thank you, Mr. Stancliffe. Follow up. Go ahead, Ms. Yeah. Representative.
Through the chair, thank you for that. Yeah, I must have overlooked it, so I'll go back and look a little deeper. Thank you. I guess my last question, this is just me really trying to understand how this works. Is this for the one instance of Tanana, or are we changing something so that future communities would have this same pathway, which is what I think we're doing? And if that's what we're doing, then which communities might be coming up next?
For us, this bill is specifically for Tanana, but go ahead, Dave. He knows
the chair, we've identified four other communities that are under the 400 limit. They seem to be percolating just fine, and this option will be available to them if they get into some sort of bind. But they would have to work with the Boundary Commission, as Tanana would do, At this point, there's no other communities that are indicating that they need to have the supply to them.
Thank you. Thank Representative you. Brooks.
Just, again, to get the conversation going as it goes to the next communities. The city of Nenana essentially went through a bankruptcy, and that required other agencies to pick up the tab, if you will. And I'm glad that they have kind of recovered from that. But it's just something we need to think about very carefully, because the way it's going, there will be cities above 400 and et cetera that will find it to their advantage to just simply give everything up and trust in the legislature and Congress to fund them.
Thank you, Representative Brooks. Other questions or comments from the committee? All right. Seeing none, Representative Allard, what is the wish of the committee?
Thank you. If there are no amendments, thank you, Chair Ruffridge. I motion to move House Bill 69, version alpha, also referred to as 33LS0407/A, be advanced from committee with the attached zero fiscal note. Do we have a fiscal note? I don't think we do.
It is a fiscal note, yes.
Okay. I didn't see it. Okay.
So do you want to amend that motion to attached fiscal note?
Yeah, just with an attached zero fiscal note.
Just remove the word zero because it
okay,
is
zero.
Not.
I don't have a copy of it, so I'm speaking uninformed.
Okay, brief eddies. Okay, back on record, Representative Allen.
So I will proceed with the I could just read it over. I'll just motion to move the House Bill 69, version alpha, also referred to as 33LS0407/A, be advanced from the committee with the attached zero fiscal note.
Wonderful. Thank you, Representative Allard. Is there any objection? Okay. Hearing none, House Bill 69 is moved from committee. We'll take a brief at ease to take care of paperwork. Thank you, Representative Cronk. We are back on record. It is 8:19 a.m. I wanted to recognize for the record that Senator Myers has joined us. Thank you, Senator. And so we have in front of us now House Bill 9. I would like to invite the bill sponsor forward, Representative Carrick and Mr. Relay. Just a brief introduction, and the amendment deadline for this was Friday. Friday at noon, and we did not receive any amendments, but it is my understanding we received some amendments here on our desk, so we will entertain those after a brief introduction.
Great, thank you. For the record, Ashley Carrick, representative for House District 35, West Fairbanks, and thank you to the committee members for taking up House Bill 9, which just adds a faculty member, full-time tenured faculty member to the University of Alaska's Board of Regents. My staff is here as well.
Thank you for the record, Stuart Relay, staff for Representative Carrick. We did produce a document for the committee that should be in your binders that addresses some of the questions that were brought up at the previous hearing. I'm more than happy to walk through that proceed however you see fit.
Thank you, Mr. Relay. Are there any questions or comments from the committee for the bill sponsor? Okay, seeing none, thank you. All right, it's back in front of the committee. What is the will of the committee? Is there any motions for amendments, Representative
Yes,
Ballard?
Sir. Thank you, Chair Ruffridge. We do have a conceptual amendment. Okay. And I guess.
Would you like to move your amendment?
Yes, I motion to move that House Bill number 9, version 9 alpha also.
This is after.
Yeah, I would like to move amendment. Can you take a brief at ease?
Brief at ease. We are back on record at 8:23. Representative Allen.
Thank you, Chair. I move amendment number one.
All right. Is there any objection?
I object for purpose of discussion, Representative McKay.
Thank you, Representative McKay. Would you like to speak to your amendment, Representative Allen?
Thank you. Amendment one is actually quite simple. It opens it up for equal opportunity for all. So if they are individuals who are affiliated with the campuses, with UA, UAF, and Southeast, these individuals who are located in different areas in rural Alaska, Healy, Bethel, any of these individuals could actually apply to become a board member as a faculty board member, and it's not limited. That also goes on to that it could be any amount. So we're not limiting it to just not a six nominees in the state of Alaska. It would be open to every single individual who's a faculty member that would like to apply for this position. That way it's fair across the board, and individuals that are perhaps located in rural communities are represented as well. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Comments, questions on the conceptual amendment number one? Representative Story.
Thank you, Co-Chair Ruffridge. Through the chair to the bill sponsor, if I might.
Please.
Yes, I thought that currently it was open to all faculty because all the campuses are under one of the main faculties, and they apply and work with that for the nominees. Could you explain that farther for me? Make sure I've got that correct.
Yes, through the chair to Representative Story. This is Representative Carrick. So essentially the way the UA governance structure works is that the faculty senate of each of the three institutions, University of Alaska Southeast, University of Alaska Fairbanks, and University of Alaska Anchorage, represents the faculty for that institution. And the institution for each of the three campuses also includes the rural and community campuses within that institution. So in other words, if you look at a chart of the campuses that are within the structure of the University of Alaska Southeast, you'll see, for example, the Sitka and the Ketchikan campus. And so a faculty member who is eligible under the provisions of this bill, who's a full-time tenured faculty, of which the university system has 490 right now across the entire system, a faculty member at the Sitka or the Ketchikan campus, for example, can participate and be a member of the University of Alaska Southeast Faculty Senate and is therefore currently eligible to serve under this legislation. So there's no restriction on a rural tenured professor who is eligible under this legislation from also being a part of the Faculty Senate. And additionally, I would just note that the bill isn't limited to Faculty Senate members. The Faculty Senates just make the selections for the two nominees for that cycle. And so it's possible to have someone who is involved and chosen for the faculty regent position as a nominee who is not on the Faculty Senate as well. So just hopefully that clarifies that a little bit.
Thank you, Representative Carrick. Is there a follow-up?
Thank you. I also wanted to reiterate with the amendment that this did go through legal. This isn't a floor amendment. It just came in late. So that was legal's take on it as well. And also when we say nominees, I want to reemphasize that I am taking out the nominees as all interested parties. When it is only to nominees, then we can limit those who apply, and I didn't want that. Just for clarification.
Thank you, Representative Allard. Representative Hemshoot.
Thank you, through the chair. Maybe it's in here and I've just not picked it up quickly enough, but Representative Carrick, are adjunct faculty eligible, or is it who is eligible to serve? Is it anyone employed in a professor position, or does it have to be tenured only or adjunct eligible?
Yes, through the chair to Representative Hemshoot, the bill is limited to tenured faculty, and so adjuncts are not eligible to be nominees in this legislation. And with this amendment, I think that would open it up potentially to all faculty, including adjuncts. However, the reason why this legislation was limited in the first place to tenured full-time faculty is because of that full experience in teaching at the university system. And so that typically includes not just teaching courses, it also includes research, it includes participating in administrative efforts with the departments they work with. And adjunct faculties can perform some of those roles, but typically not to the same capacity that a tenured full-time faculty member will.
Thank you. Through the chair, how many tenured professors are there in the system? As I'm looking at this amendment, you know, worst case scenario, they all apply and then somebody has to weed through however many applications. On the other hand, I like the idea of people being open to apply. So if you could just help me find out, do you know how many tenured professors there are?
Yes, through the chair to Representative Himshute, there are 490 tenured faculty in the University of Alaska system currently, and there are 162 that are currently eligible for tenure. So the process of obtaining tenure typically takes about a year or so and is in consultation with the administration and the department. And, you know, I've been very close friends with faculty who have gone through that tenure process, and it is fairly rigorous, and currently there are 162 faculty that are eligible. So theoretically, they could go through that process and become tenured faculty at the university system within the next few months to a year.
Thank you. Follow-up?
Yeah, one last quick follow-up. Thank you, through the chair. So potentially 652 people who could be interested, and so by having it, can you explain the purpose of narrowing it to six?
Through the chair to Representative Himshute, I think the value of narrowing it to six as opposed to allowing all interested tenured faculty is just the process that the governor will need to go through in order to select a faculty member. There's a lot of value, I believe, in how the current student regent process works, and it helps to filter so that students have to go through a series of steps in order to be considered for appointment as a student regent. And this doesn't mirror exactly, but does sort of parallel a process in place. If the governor has to choose from a list of 100 or more names, or even 50 or more names, even 25 or more names, I think that there's potentially a lot of challenge the governor would have in fully vetting those candidates, where in putting this legislation together, I felt fairly strongly that having a list of six allowed the governor a lot of flexibility in decision-making while still not creating a situation where someone was just chosen by the governor kind of beforehand, or, you know, really makes it a transparent process in consultation with the faculty, in consultation with the faculty senate, and then still allowing the governor the full purview to choose a nominee from that list.
Other questions, comments? Representative Brocks.
Yes, thank you. Through the chair, the Faculty Senate, I suppose that is open to any tenured faculty member, or is it open to all faculty members regardless of tenure?
Yeah, through the chair to Representative Brocks. The Faculty Senate, you can participate and be a member as any type of faculty member. So if you're adjunct faculty, I don't know that there are many adjunct faculty that get really involved in the Faculty Senate, but my understanding is that that's open to them. If you are teaching at the University of Alaska, you are allowed to participate in the Faculty Senate in a meaningful way.
Follow up.
In the Faculty Senate is not, it's an organization associated with university, but it's limited in who can join, similar to the Judicial Council, or not the Judicial, but the Bar Association. There we go.
Through the chair to Representative Brocks, I think it's most helpful to think of the Faculty Senate as the sort of parallel entity to the student government. So one can participate in student government meetings, but in order to be a student senator at one of the campuses, you have to actually run and be elected by the student body. And the Faculty Senate works very similarly. Any faculty member can participate in the proceedings of the Faculty Senate, just like individuals can participate with the legislature here. But in order to be a faculty senator, you have to actually run and be elected by your peers. And so that's essentially the parallel to the student government at the University of Alaska campuses.
Okay, thank you.
Other questions, comments? Representative Story.
Through the chair, to Rep. Carrick. So if I'm getting this right, when the Faculty Senate is sifting through the two nominees, they are looking for what sort of things would they be looking for?
Through the chair to Representative Story, I imagine just in speaking with faculty anecdotally, they would really be looking for folks who have the time and energy to commit, first of all, because being on the Board of Regents is a very hefty commitment, time-wise. And I know that when you first come in as a regent, you're given huge binders of documents, and you really need to become very familiar with the university system very quickly. So for, that would be a major component of serving as the regent. Additionally, I think the faculty senates would probably be looking for someone who represents sort of the interests of faculty going forward, looking at things like program cuts on a holistic level, looking at the research capacity of each institution on a holistic level. And I imagine that the faculty senates would really want to put someone forward that best represented their interests and the interests of the university system. And there are many eligible individuals who I think would be very much qualified to take that on. And again, I just want to note for the committee that under this legislation, you don't have to be a member of the Faculty Senate to be a nominee for that institution for the region position. The Faculty Senate is just the body that decides the nominees. So in other words, you do not have to be a Faculty Senate member in order to be a nominee. You can be a faculty member that simply participates and asks to be nominated.
Thank you, Representative Carrick. Follow-up, Representative Story? No? Any other questions or comments for the amendment? Representative Ballard.
That's, if it's okay, if I can just give a couple closing comments. Please. Thank you. I wanted to make sure that the body and the public knows that when you take out the word nominee and you put in interested faculty, you're opening it up to all Alaskans. And one of the things I heard over and over was in regards to HB 9 was that it wasn't fair that a faculty member wasn't on the Board of Regents. And so for me, it's very important that regardless if you're an adjunct or a what I would say the Senate would pick as a tenure faculty member, that it's really important that every individual within the university system could be represented. And when you only limit it to six nominees, you're taking out areas that might not be able to get nominated by the Senate, and that would be rural Alaska. And there is not representation of that. So I really want to encourage people that if this is such a good bill, HB 9, then we need to make sure that everybody could be represented and have the option to apply for this position. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Representative Ballard. All right, seeing no more. Representative McKay, do you maintain your objection?
I remove my objection, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative McKay. Is there any further objection to the amendment to House Bill 9?
Objection.
Thank you, Representative Story. Is that something you'd like to speak to?
Sure. I really appreciate the sentiment of the maker of the amendment and wanting to make sure that there's, you know, everyone knows that they can be a part of this. I do think that everyone knows they can be a part of this through the current system. And I think it's important that there are some different levels of applying. And I guess I should have asked if they'd be removed. But I just know it's important that peers have looked at the nominees and make sure that they can have the time and that they have been dependable in meetings on their campus and would make sure that they're connecting. And I think the purpose of this whole bill is that the regents, that to have a faculty nominee on there, is that they're have a faculty nominee that has been vetted by their peers and has been put forward. So I still think that everyone can have a voice in the process. And so I did, but I think that there is a process through this current bill.
Thank you, Representative Story. Representative Prox.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is just a policy call. There's different ideas. I guess there's currently a growing number of Alaskans who are upset with the provision in the Constitution that essentially gives, we'll call it a non-governmental organization, a preferred dominant role, really, in selecting judges. And I know this isn't the courts, but it does fall outside the customary equal treatment for Alaskans. Anybody can join the, or can nominate themselves or apply for the Board of Regents. Currently, this departs from that and sets up a privileged position. So, as currently written, this amendment act opens it up to more people, and I think that is a better idea to have it more open. There's a sorting process in the executive branch for dealing with it if we get dozens of applicants. I think it's preferable to leave it open to more people. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Prox. Representative Hemshute.
Thank you, Chair Ruffridge. I guess I'm looking at this more like the process I went through to sit in this seat today, where I had to convince people that I would be able to advocate for them. And so I like the idea that people would be vetted by the Faculty Senate and elected, not elected, but selected as nominees. So I like the spirit of the amendment, but I don't think, I think it could end up being somewhat unwieldy. So and at the end of the day, I don't think I can support this.
Thank you. Representative Ballard.
Thank you. And just to reiterate what Representative Hemshute just said, it is election is to be held. It is not a selection. It is in the bill that it is an election.
Representative McCormick.
Thank you. So I'll just add that, I appreciate the sentiment of wanting to include as many folks as possible. I do think there's value in the way that it's currently written. In regards to the requirement for being tenured, I would view that similarly to residency requirements in the state of Alaska for running for office and needing to live in Alaska for a period of time, as opposed to just moving to Alaska and then running for office right away. So, I think there's value in the way that it's currently written, and I intend to keep it that way. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative McCormick. I guess I do have a quick question just on that, for the bill sponsor. The current process to becoming a Board of Regent member is you apply, and if you are selected, then you go through the confirmation process. Is that an accurate description of that process?
To the chair, Representative Ruffridge, currently for the 8-year term serving regent, it's essentially a conversation that'll take place between the boards and commissions office, the governor's office, and interested individuals. There's not necessarily an application, but the governor does get to choose nominees the way that the governor gets to choose nominees for boards and commissions generally. So the boards and commissions office will work with potentially interested individuals from a variety of education or industry or other backgrounds, and then the governor will choose those individuals directly for the legislature to confirm.
Thank you. Representative Allen.
Thank you. And I wanted to just make one last comment. With all the other Board of Regents, they are allowed to apply throughout the entire state. And then the governor picks that one person. And unfortunately, with this one, it's not that way. This bill would then say, we limit who the governor gets to pick instead of him being able to pick amongst all Alaskans that would be qualified to be in here. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Ballard. Any other questions or comments? Representative Story.
Thank you, and this is to the maker of the amendment. What did the faculty think about the change that you're proposing?
Representative Hemshoot, or Representative Story, when I spoke to different faculty members, and I did speak to other Board of Regent members in regards to this, they wanted it to be open to all Alaskans from any community, not limited to six nominees through an election process. They felt that it was more fair to be chosen the way they're chosen as well.
Representative Story?
How many faculty did you get to speak with?
I don't remember the exact number.
Thank you.
Any other questions, discussion?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I just wanted to note for the committee to Representative Allard's comment, this amendment does absolutely open up to all interested faculty and in a way that's perhaps more broad or inclusive than the current process outlined in the legislation. But I did just want to note that through the current process outlined in the legislation, faculty from rural Alaska are absolutely able to become a faculty regent. There's no restriction on that. This is not limited to the three main campuses, if that makes clear as mud, hopefully.
Thank you, Representative Carrick. Representative Story, do you maintain your objection?
Yes.
Thank you. Let us call the roll on this amendment, please.
Representative Story.
No.
Representative Hemshoot.
No.
Representative McKay.
Yes.
Representative McCormick.
No.
Representative Fox.
Yes.
Commissioner Allard.
Yes.
Commissioner Rutledge.
Yes. Okay, with a vote of four yeas and three nays, amendment number one from Representative Allard is adopted. All right, is there any further discussion for House Bill 9 as amended from the committee? All right, seeing none. Okay. Madam Co-Chair, what
Thank
is the
you.
Vote of the committee?
Thank you, Chair Ruffridge. I move the House Bill Number 9, Version Alpha, also referred to as 33-LS0197A, be advanced from the committee as amended with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note and authorized legislative legal to make technical and conforming changes as needed.
Thank you. Is there objection? All right, seeing none, House Bill 9 has passed from committee as amended. I will take a brief at ease to sign the paperwork. Thank you. We are back on record, 8:51 a.m., Education Committee, and we have before us House Bill 10. Sponsored by Representative Carrick. So welcome back, Representative Carrick and Mr. Relay. And if you would like to begin your presentation on House Bill 10, and it looks like we also have a few invited testifiers online. And whenever you are ready, you may begin.
Great. Thank you, Co-Chair Ruffridge and members of the House Education Committee. Thanks for entertaining not just one, but two, I think, great pieces of legislation this morning related to the University of Alaska. For the record, I'm Ashley Carrick, representative for House District 35 in West Fairbanks, which includes the University of Alaska Fairbanks main campus. Thank you for taking the time this morning to hear House Bill 10, which is also known as the Textbook Cost Transparency Act. As a quick fun fact, this is the only minority-to-minority companion bill in the legislature currently. So this is the House companion to Senate Bill 13, which is being carried by my colleague from North Pole in the other body, Senator Rob Myers. Senator Myers and his staff have been working diligently on this over the course of both the current and the previous legislature. Over the past few decades, the cost of higher education, including technical and vocational education, has gone up significantly. And included in the rising costs of post-secondary education is the cost of course materials, especially textbooks. So the Textbook Cost Transparency Act simply allows students to know if there are low-cost or no-cost options for the course materials they need for specific classes. Students would be able to use low-cost or no-cost search functions when they're navigating the university's online course catalog, known as UA Online, as they are registering for a course. Low-cost resources are defined as a resource that does not cost more than four times the minimum wage. So currently, a low-cost resource would be any resource which costs approximately $43.40 or less. Course materials include textbooks, computer software, and several forms of media. It should be noted that many faculty currently go to great lengths to ensure a supportive learning environment for their students, including considering the course materials and the costs that those present for their students. Additionally, this is something that University of Alaska administrators have been working to address, though each of the three main campus institutions in Juneau, Anchorage, and Fairbanks have taken their own approaches. So this bill would bring uniformity to these efforts and provide for a more transparent, easy to navigate, and streamlined process across the University of Alaska system. We also have an effective date set far enough out to allow the university's administration time to implement the provisions of this bill, giving the administration until July 1st of 2026 to make these changes. This bill does not dictate to the faculty what course materials they can use, and it is designed to give the university and the faculty the greatest amount of flexibility and discretion for implementation while giving students a better idea of their school costs for the next semester. As an alumna of both the University of Alaska Fairbanks and the University of Alaska Anchorage, I certainly would have liked to know more about the cost of my materials sooner in the registration process. Additionally, I can say that it is frustrating as a student to find out sometimes on the first day of class when reading the syllabus what the textbook will be, and then having to choose between buying a textbook at a marked up price at the university bookstore or waiting several weeks into the semester to have a lower cost option delivered in the mail. I'm bringing this bill forward because the cost of higher education is a major issue for students. While we might think about the cost of materials and textbooks being just a small piece of the overall cost of tuition and fees, the additional and potentially high cost of materials can pose an undue financial burden on students that can cause them to drop their classes or act as a barrier to starting or completing their coursework. While there are circumstances where higher cost textbooks cannot be avoided, and we want to allow faculty the flexibility to make those decisions about which options to offer to their students, this bill simply allows students to better budget their school expenses and know when they can expect to pay these costs. I just want to thank again Senator Myers and his staff for their efforts and diligence on this issue and for allowing me to work on this bill with them. And at this point, Mr. Chairman, I want to turn it over to my staff, Stuart Relay, to read through our sectional and introduce our invited testifiers. And thank you again for hearing House Bill 10.
Thank you, Representative Carrick. Mr. Relay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Stuart Relay, staff for Representative Carrick. And thank you again to the committee for hearing this bill. Pretty important bill with that. So Section 1 simply establishes House Bill 10 as the Textbook Cost Transparency Act. It creates the short title. Section 2 is the bulk of the bill, and it basically outlines the information that the University of Alaska must provide in its online course catalog, also known as UA Online. Relating to course materials and automatic fees required for the materials to the extent practicable. The section also provides statutory definitions for course materials, as referenced in this bill again, online course schedule, low-cost resources, and zero-cost resources. The section also directs UA Online to include search functions to identify courses with only zero cost or low cost options. And Section 3, as Representative Carrick mentioned, establishes an effective date of July 1st, 2026. And again, that's to accommodate the university's OIT upgrades and all that good stuff. With that, Mr. Chairman, that is the sectional. And we do have a few invited testifiers, most of whom are university folks that can answer any questions about what the university is doing. We also do have two folks. We have the president of the UAA student government, Katie Scugan, and the president of the UAF student government, Ashlyn Brooks, online as well, to provide some the student perspective, if you will.
Thank you very much, Mr. Relay. And we do have some folks online. If you're okay, I will move to invite a testimony, and then we will have questions at the end. So online, it looks like we do have Katie Scugan, president of USUAA, and if you are online, you are unmuted, and we are ready to hear your testimony.
Hello, can you hear me well?
We can, thank you.
Okay, thank you. Good morning, representatives of the House and members of this committee. My name is Katie Scugan, and I'm the student body president at UAA. And thank you so much for this opportunity to speak on an issue that is very, very important to not only me, but also my fellow students and constituents. So it's my distinct privilege to speak on this bill. And I just want to say that when I was deciding which college to choose, cost was a huge determining factor. And thanks to being a UA scholar and APS, the choice was that much easier. I can confidently say that the issue of affordable higher education is true for every other high school graduate. But these barriers do not end after being admitted into the university. So in my role, I have students approaching me daily with their concerns. And one of the very first things that was brought to my attention, actually the first week of September, was by a student in the nursing program. And about a week into the class, she and her peers were informed that they would have to purchase a program that costs $623 each. And when I think of her, I think about all the other students who might have not come forward, who are working towards a career in the healthcare field, or any field for that matter, but are confronted with the undue burden and stress of these financial roadblocks. And because of the cost of course materials not being disclosed prior to registration, students just can't budget accordingly. And another person I know took an art class, and even though she tried to prepare for the class, she found out the first week that the supplies would be over $200, so she ended up having to borrow money to pay for those expenses. And unfortunately, I know that these stories are not unique. I hear these stories time and time again, dead ends and surprise costs that students can't plan for even if they wanted to. I also want to emphasize this issue is not specific to any single department or college. In fact, it's not specific to any one university. The issue extends to our satellite campuses, our sister campuses, UAS and UAS, and it disproportionately affects students in rural areas who already do not have equal access. So it's crucial and necessary that the online course schedule identifies required course materials in the description so that students, wherever they may be, are not finding themselves scrambling to come up with the extra money to fund their education. And we just deserve to know what our course materials are way before the first week of class. And on the point of the zero cost or low cost resource search function, that's something that UAA adopted in the fall, and it's positively impacted hundreds of students. So now students don't have to play a guessing game or reading game, and we can make an informed decision about which courses we can afford to be enrolled in. And I strongly believe that if there's anything that can be done to make higher education in Alaska more attractive and obtainable, it's by promoting and protecting these kinds of opportunities. And frankly, if we want more college students entering the workforce after graduation here, if we want more people actually choosing the UA system for higher education, addressing this issue at the root of its cause means not gatekeeping or withholding when courses are more affordable or accessible. And all things considered, HB 10 and likewise SB 13 would ensure the stability and security of textbook cost transparency. And the transparency between students and a university is not something that I alone can fix. That's what I had to tell the person who came to me with this problem. But this act provides a very feasible solution to these concerns. And I want to stress that this is not an abstract or hypothetical concern. It happens every semester, and it'll continue to happen if action is not taken. So I urge you to support this bill, and I cannot express enough how essential this act is to current and prospective students all across the state. And again, thank you so much for your time and for your service.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Is there any questions for the testifier? Hearing none, we will move.
I'd like to ask one.
Oh, well, we do have a question. Representative McKay.
Sorry, Mr. Chairman, I'm a little late. I guess I'm kind of amazed, actually, that we have to pass a state law to do this, but okay. All the textbooks in the University of Alaska, they would probably be on Amazon, right?
So this would be a question for the testifier.
I guess from, well, whoever wants to answer it. I don't care.
Well, if it was...
They're going to be on Amazon, so you could look up on Amazon the cost of the book anytime. So I'm not sure if we've got a problem here that we're, or a solution that's looking for a problem, but it seems like you could look on Amazon and see the prices for all these books. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative McKay, we will have questions for the bill sponsor in just a second. I will allow Katie Scoggin to respond to that if she has a response, and then we'll move on to other invited testifiers.
Yes, thank you, Representative McKay. So the issue, that's true. You could probably find these books on Amazon or Chegg. I rent them sometimes or buy them online. But the issue is that we don't even know which books, like which textbooks or course materials correlate with the courses that we register for. It's kind of just this unknown, mysterious thing that we have to navigate first day of class sometimes the first week. So that's really the issue, is that we just don't even know which books to purchase, if that makes sense. So.
Thank you for your response. Did you have a follow-up, Representative McKay? Okay, thank you. Any other questions or comments for the testifier? All right. Hearing none, we will move on to Ashlyn Brooks, president of ASUAF. Please introduce yourself for the record and your affiliation, and begin your testimony, please.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Good morning. My name is Ashlyn Brooks. I am the current president of the student government at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. I'm calling in support of House Bill 10. As a student, I know how frustrating it can be to sign up for a class that already costs hundreds of dollars and then find out weeks later that you need to top up a couple hundred more to buy the textbook or specific course materials. This is a real problem for many of our lower-income students on campus who may not have money in savings to drop on textbooks. Just like Ms. Scoggin at UAA, I've also heard of students at UAF who had to take out a last-minute loan in order to pay for their books. On a more personal note, I'm lucky enough to not be in the aforementioned circumstance. However, trying to get through college debt-free means that I have to carefully budget out how much I will need each semester to pay for classes. These last-minute costs associated with textbooks and course materials make it difficult to budget properly for course costs. For these reasons, the students of UAF support House Bill 10 and urge each of you to support this bill as well. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there any questions for Ashlyn Brooks before we let her go? All right, seeing none, thank you for your testimony. All right, that brings us back to the bill sponsor. Is there any questions or comments for the bill sponsor? Representative Himshu.
Thank you, through the chair, Representative Carrick. In the materials from Sarah Perman, State Relations Manager at UA, she provides a letter and includes some materials about zero-cost, low-cost materials transparency efforts. And there's a line that is sticking with me that I just want to get your thoughts on. It says, finding the line again. Here it is. It is important to note that each of our universities, UAA, UAF, and UAS, are subject to federal regulations that require us to provide accurate and timely information about the cost of books or required materials. How does this bill... does this bill drill down deeper and tell me how this bill is improving things beyond the federal regulation.
I'm going to pass that one to my staff, if it's okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hemshoot, through the chair. So, yes, this is just kind of building off that. I can't speak specifically to the federal regulations, but this is just providing in state statute that that you know they have to disclose whether there are low cost or no cost options for that class when it's up on UA Online.
Thank you,
Mr. Relay. Is there a follow up?
No.
Well, and through the chair to Representative Hemshoot, I'll just add too that while there are federal regulations, that doesn't mean we can't be a little more accurate and a little more timely with what is available and what students can expect. And I do think this bill does expand a little bit on the efforts the university is currently undergoing to enact enact similar measures. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hemshoot. Representative Story?
Yes, thank you, Co-Chair Ruffridge. Through the chair, Representative Carrick, I heard the invited testifiers say that oftentimes when students came to college or to any post-secondary that they were surprised at the cost of the textbooks. And I am wondering, this bill does not say anything about the step of educating students about the span of cost that textbooks can't say. And on number one, it says on the first page of the bill, line 10, it says required course materials. It seems like on that line, it should be very clearly spelled and their cost. So currently, can you tell me if I went to this website where it would say the cost of the materials were?
Thank you, Representative Story, through the chair. So this bill doesn't provide the exact cost because that would just be a burden to the faculty that would have to, you know, find, you know, the exact prices and whatnot. This just would in UA Online have search functions that say, you know, this course has low cost course materials, and as Representative Carrick said in her intro, the definition of a low cost material is provided for in this bill is four times the minimum wage. So currently our minimum wage is $10.85, so that'd be $43 and some change. So anything below $43 and I think 40 cents would be considered low cost, and then no cost would not have a cost.
Yes, through the chair. Rep. Carrick, do you know of any how the university currently lets students know, or our local school districts know of the costs of textbooks?
Through the chair to Representative Story. So in your backup documents from the university system, it outlines how each of the campuses has worked to advertise, I suppose, low and no cost materials. And you can see that at UAA, for example, there's an effort to underway slash already ongoing where you can select zero textbook cost sections. But what strikes me in looking through this document is there's not uniformity across the system right now in having those options available on UA Online. And so a student very frequently does not actually know the cost of a textbook or the materials until right before class is about to begin. Sometimes on the first day of class, you're finding out, especially if you're taking an online course. And so this bill provides that uniformity and just allows students who are, say, taking an elective drawing course, for example, or an elective psychology course, if there's multiple sections of that course available, you could select on UA Online that intro psychology course and free or low cost text, and you would get filtered classes that would have both of those options present if they existed.
Follow up?
Please.
So, through the chair. So if I went online, there's nothing that would alert me as a student right away to say, please check on the cost of the required materials for each class.
Through the chair to Representative Story, no.
Thank you.
Yes, through the chair, there's nothing currently in UI Online that says whether you have materials or texts required for that class or not, much less what those materials or texts are up front. When you register for a class, you simply put in the CRN number it's called and you register. And until the syllabus comes out and the course is built, typically on Blackboard or on Canvas, which is the sort of online platform that hosts the sort of course information, you don't necessarily know until that point, or unless you receive an email from your instructor before the class begins letting you know what those materials may be. Additionally, I will just note that the CRN number for that class will correspond to a number at the main campus bookstores. So you can take that number and before the semester begins, go into the bookstore and figure out what the texts and materials might be. The one thing I'll note there from a student perspective is while that's a useful tool, many times, I've had it happen many times to myself and others, those textbooks or materials will change before the semester starts or there's an additional thing that's added. And so even with some of the measures that are in place to help students prepare for class, it's not uniform and it, I would argue, is not enough right now.
Follow up?
Please.
Through the chair. So what is the deadline for a faculty member to have their materials posted for the upcoming semester?
Through the chair to Representative Story, I will note some classes don't actually require any materials at all. So that's, but faculty are expected to put together their syllabus and create their course platform, usually a few weeks before the semester begins, and share that with students. Sometimes that course is not actually open, quote unquote. So it's not, it's being built, but it's not actually shared and open for students to log in and see it until very shortly before the class begins.
Follow up?
Please.
So there's not a requirement by a fixed date for faculty?
Representative Story through the chair, that no, not in this bill. And currently, my understanding is no.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Allen.
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Carrick, did you check with how much manpower this would take with any of the representatives from UAA?
Through the chair to co-chair Allard, the university would take on some administrative legwork to make this happen, and that's part of why the effective date is pushed out to 2026. In terms of how many hours it would take, I don't know that the university may be able to speak to that, although I suspect that it would be something they would kind of figure out as they were going. It is my understanding that they could absorb taking on the administrative work of putting this together with current staffing, which is why up to this point we have not received a fiscal note from the university.
But you haven't actually spoken to any of the representatives from UA, Representative Carrick?
Through the chair, Co-Chair Allard, we have spoken with the university administration and they have told us, you know, it would be an extra administrative burden to put this together.
Follow up. So we have the Board of Regents. Have you spoken to anybody on the Board of Regents about perhaps implementing this instead of making it? I'm concerned to make this a state law and just allowing the university to do something simply or continue what they're doing now. Have you spoken to any of the members of the Board of Regents?
Through the chair to Co-Chair Allard, I've not spoken with the Regents members. And just the one thing I'll say there is I just think that there's a lot of value in having the uniformity across the system and making sure it happens within a reasonable time frame. This is something that does potentially set individuals back in their education. Potentially, you could register for classes and then drop them later if you realize you need a $200 textbook. Working families just really struggle to be able to afford higher education in general. And I think that left to the university's own devices, they may implement a uniform system across all three institutions. but it may take a very long time, even if it does happen. So part of the reason to put this in state law is to make sure that process is working with the university administration, giving them time to implement it, but also making sure it happens and making sure it is actually uniform across all three institutions.
Follow up, please.
Thanks.
Just a quick comment. I have a problem with it being state law instead of allowing the UAA to make these decisions and go through their chain of command. Okay, thank you.
Representative Ballard, Representative Prox.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. through the chair, I guess I'm flummoxed. I agree that this is a problem. It was a problem 30, 40 years ago, however long that was when I was attending. But as Representative Ballard said, it seems odd to put this to accomplish this through the legislature rather than through the Board of Regents. And I had a question. You mentioned that students select courses based on the cost of the curriculum, which strikes me as odd. You would think they would select the course based on the need for the degree or the reputation of the instructor or something like that. Could you explain why they point that out, low-cost curriculum, currently?
Through the chair to Representative Prox, just having been a student for a very long time, I can say there's a lot of factors that will go into the decision-making for which course you will take and which section of a course. The time it fits into your schedule is one. The instructor is definitely a factor. And I do think that if you saw, say, four sections of the same course and one had low-cost options or no cost listed as an option, that may factor into your decision as well. A good example might be if I'm taking a course that's a part of my degree program and builds into the curriculum for future higher level classes in that degree program, I may very well want to take the class that's on the main campus with the best instructor with the higher cost text because I know that that's going to be really important for my future classes in that program. But if I'm taking an elective class that I must take, and as many students, as all students have to take to get their post-secondary education, it may not be as critical to me to have all of those factors be in place. And I do think that one of the big hurdles that every student must get through in order to get through their degree program is cost, and materials and texts are a very large part of that.
Agreed. Interesting. Thank you. We have a representative from the university here. Is she here to answer questions and be held under the limelight?
We do have some folks online for testimony as well. Did you want to have any of those individuals up to answer some of those questions?
To the co-chair, we do have some folks online who are available for questions from the university system.
Yes, we have Paul Layer, Vice President for Academics from UAF, and Michael Seary, Vice Chancellor for UAS. Representative Prox, did you want to direct that question to either one of those individuals?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Through the chair, to whomever is able to answer this. I see that you have a zero fiscal note here, but within the text, there are going to be costs. I understand that you're stating that you can absorb the cost, if you will, but I'm wondering what that might cost the university and why that wasn't stated in the fiscal note.
Because
typically it would. And actually, I have another bill that I'm on having to do with PFD, and I thought that was minimal cost, and it turned out to be in excess of $100,000.
Thank you, Representative Prox. Representative Carrick, is there an individual you would like to bring online to answer that question?
Mr. Co-Chair, I believe Paul Lair would be the best person to answer that question.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Lair, Hopefully you heard that question, and if so, introduce yourself for the record and provide us a little insight, please.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. For the record, Paul Lehr, Vice President for Academic Students and Research with the University of Alaska System, and thank you for that question regarding the fiscal note and the cost. As many members of the committee are aware, the university was allocated funding last year to improve our student information system, our SIS system, also known as Banner, of which the UA Online is a piece of that. And so we feel that as we are upgrading that student information system, the spirit and the letter of the requirements that are in this legislation will be part of that new system that we bring online to improve the student experience. So we are very aware of that. And in your packet, I would point out you see three different approaches from the three universities regarding low cost, zero cost, or textbook transparency. And these are working under the current student information system, which is a bit antiquated. And so each of the universities, through their grassroots efforts, has taken in steps to improve, to implement parts of this and try to make materials more available to students. I appreciate the comments from Representative Carrick and the students who were on the call today. It is something that we are very conscious of and we are working to improve. But regarding the fiscal note again, we feel that we can, it will be a cost, but it will be part of that cost that we will be incorporating into our improved student information system. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Please.
Yes. So I guess not exactly a rhetorical question, but Representative Carrick, in this bill brings up a very valid point. As I say, 40 years ago, actually more, I was surprised several times to find the not know the textbook when you're enrolling in a course, and the day of or the day before, sometimes the day after, you found out that the textbook was going to cost well over $100 back in the early 70s. And it just seems like a good practice to let the customer know what the cost is before they have to commit to the sale. And I'm just puzzled why the university hasn't been able to implement this practice on its own. Why do we need the legislature to tell you to do something that makes perfectly good business sense?
Mr. Lehr?
Thank you. Again, for the record, Paul Lehr, Vice President for Academic Students Research at the University of Alaska System. It's a very good point that is made. And I remember also the cost of some of my textbooks as well when I was a student. For most of our classes, that textbook is known. And, for example, in the UAF materials, as the student is going through registration, they can go to the online version of the bookstore and see the cost of that material before they actually register for the class. There are some exceptions to that when we have to bring in an adjunct or another instructor at the last minute. But in general, I think we are moving to that point where at the time of registration, and fall registration is going to start here in a couple of weeks, the cost and the textbook are going to be known and are going to be available as a student is on UA Online and can reference the class through the bookstore. So there are some exceptions, but we are moving to that point where the textbook cost is known at the time of registration for students. And also, again, as UAA points out, flags for zero cost or low cost texts are available as well. Thank you.
Follow-up, Representative Brox.
Thank you. And follow-up. As I said, I'm always hesitant to have the legislature dictate something that makes common sense. But the other side of it is the legislature, in its effort to dictate something that they think makes common sense, puts people who actually have to implement the program in a bind, gives them something they can't do. Is this something that the university, I guess the first question is, does the university need this legislation? And the second part of that would be, in your view, could we be giving the university a responsibility that they can't meet?
Mr. Lehr?
Through the chair, this is Paul Lehr, again, University of Alaska. Representative Prax, I believe that was your question. And to implement this will require effort from our teams here at the university. And I don't have the exact cost that it would take to do this. I agree that the spirit of this is the right thing to do. And it is something that we are working toward right now. But I think as we implement our new student information system, this will be a core part of that student interface. And it's a goal to have. And, you know, the phrase "to the extent practicable" is in the legislation, and we will work very hard within our scope to implement this. There will be exceptions, but for most of our classes, our courses and curriculum, we should be able to provide that information to students in a timely manner. Thank you.
Thank you. May I follow up? Yes. Thank you. I guess I hate to be sounding facetious, but we live in an increasingly litigious society. And if we tell the university they have to do something, then there's perhaps an opportunity I guess we give an opportunity for the courts eventually to tell you have to do something. So if it is difficult, that would be important to know before we tell you have to do it. So do you foresee this situations where the university just isn't going to be able to comply with this statute? And we might end up in court.
Through the chair, Representative Prax, to be honest, I don't know the details there. I do believe that we can implement most, if not all, of the requirements in this bill. I'd have to get back with the universities to see if there are pieces that would be difficult for us to meet in the time frame provided, but I think right now we are in a position to provide most of that material. But you know, I can't speak for what the courts might want to do if we fail here on some of these areas, but we will, within the scope of the provisions 1 through 4, we will work to implement those in a timely manner as we are moving forward. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lehr. Representative Prox, Representative Allard.
Thank you. Mr. Lehr, I have a question for you. Have you gone to speak to UA as far as President Pitney's opinion on this matter or the Board of Regents? And the reason I'm concerned that we are putting UA in position where, like Representative Prox said, for a lawsuit, and if this was something that they felt that they could complete and do on their own, they would have done it. And to pass state legislation, I feel like we might be putting them in a situation that opens up a can of worms. Could you address some of those questions in there in reference to who you've spoken to and the support of the university?
Through the chair, Paul Lehr, University of Alaska Vice President. I have. I work in the system office and have spoken to President Pitney about this. I have not talked to the board members or the chair of the Academic and Student Affairs Committee of the board about this yet. That is Regent Perdue, but I work very closely with her and will get her opinion on this proposal as it's going forward. But I apologize. I have not had a chance to touch base with her on this bill at this point in time, but you know, I think President Pitney, through her efforts to improve the student experience, again, this will be part of that upgrade of that new system that we will be implementing here with the results of the legislative appropriation. So I can't speak directly for the president, but she is very much aware of trying to make the student experience a better one for our students. And clearly cost is high on her mind, and cost for students for materials, books, et cetera, is something that we are looking very closely at. So thank you.
Thank you. Can I do a follow-up, please? Actually, it's okay. I'll ask Representative Carrick.
Thank you. And I do want to recognize we do have Sarah Perman in the room that is able to answer some of these questions as well. So I'm going to go to Representative McKay, and then we'll invite Sarah up here to answer some of those questions. Representative McKay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Through the chair, I just wanted to give an example of where the university may not be able to comply, and that is when a professor can specify a textbook for a class that might, for example, cost $100. And then he or she may find out right before classes start that the book's out of print. I think that happens quite often. I recall that happening when I was in school. So suddenly they got to scramble and find an alternative, which might cost $200. Nobody's fault, the book's out of print, but suddenly they're in violation of state law. So I think that's probably the best example I can think of. I'm sure I don't oppose this. I think it's fine, but when you pass a state law, you have to sort of think about, well, what if they cannot comply for that's not through no fault of their own. They're going to go to jail because they didn't post the right book price. I don't know. I just don't think it's very practical. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative McKay. And we'll invite Sarah Perman up to the microphone. Got a couple of questions for folks from the university, and thank you for providing your written testimony. Did you want to provide additional context to some of the questions?
Good morning, through the chair, Ruffridge. My name is Sarah Perman. I'm the State Relations Manager for the University of Alaska System. I did just want to take a moment to respond to two of the questions that I had heard. First, I'll take a quick stab at the question from Representative Prox about compliance. I think, actually, Representative McKay did quite a nice job at highlighting areas where there may be unanticipated consequences. One other area we've identified in internal conversations that are challenges. They're not insurmountable, but they are challenges. For example, when it comes down to fall semester, our faculty are required to have that course schedule uploaded to the UA online system by April. And we know that those are sections that will be available. However, in some of those cases, the faculty assigned to that won't be selected yet. So for us at the moment, to have our course materials assigned as soon as the course registration goes live is a challenge. And that's the biggest barrier there is potentially, like we mentioned, with adjunct faculty or brand new faculty. It could be that we have four course sections on intro to speech, and three of those four professors have taught this before and know their materials. There could be one that up until that last month is putting those materials together. So we do foresee some challenges at the moment, and we're having internal conversations on how to address that and how we can get those available. It could be anything like, you know, within 60 days of course beginning, these materials are available and are show up on the online schedule planner. So that is, like I said, it's not an insurmountable hurdle, but it is currently a reality that we are considering and are facing. And then to the second question from Representative Allard about President Pitney and the Board of Regents. President Pitney defers to the Board of Regents on this particular state and or this policy question, and the Board of Regents at this point has taken no official stance on this. So.
Thank you. Representative Allard.
Thank you. It's through the chair. I'm just concerned that we're making a state law when the school, the university, could just do it on their own, and for some reason they're not. And that is alarming to me, that we're forcing their hand by a state law. Do you have any other opinion on why we want to do a state law to force the hand? Because the university, if they had the resources and the time, they would just do this if they felt it was the right thing to do.
through the chair to Co-Chair Allard. I think that, to the students' points we've heard today, I think Katie Scoggin made a good point that if it's not required, it may not happen. I don't think that is the case. I think very clearly with the implementation of the our new student information system, we are working to that ends already. We are going in that direction. I think this is an active measure to get us there faster. That being said, whether that's necessary for us or not, it's difficult to say. We've had internal conversations. Would this be potentially better as intent language? Is there something else? But we are able to rise to and meet this challenge. And so it's not, like I said, it's not insurmountable is the need there. I don't know that I feel comfortable saying yes or no in this case, but I recognize the value of it.
Thank you. And through the chair, if something happens and something isn't on the website and a student says, you know what, the book price wasn't there, that's not what the state law says, and because of that, I'm going to sue the university. How are you guys going to, I say you guys, I apologize, how is the university going to address that with a lawsuit, potentially? I mean, I feel like we're setting this up for failure with the university. What's your thought on that?
Through the chair to Co-Chair Allard, I will be quite direct and say I am unfortunately not the legal counsel for the university, so I can't tell you the exact situation and the steps we would take, but that is a concern.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Any other questions or comments for the bill sponsor, Representative Hemshute?
Through the chair, my questions are for Rep. Carrick. My first question is, maybe this question has been asked, but is there faculty support for this? Has the Faculty Senate weighed in with, we want to do this, or we're against it, or?
Through the chair to Representative Hemshute, the faculty senates have not taken a position at any of the campuses on this legislation, to my knowledge. It does pose a burden administratively, and there's potentially challenges on the faculty side of it. Just in working to prepare your classes, you have to prepare a little bit sooner and a little bit more thoroughly. If I might be able to the chair, address a couple of the points that have been brought up thus far. I think to the question of why is this useful or necessary to put into state law? One of the things that I've noticed over the years at the University of Alaska system, which I love very much, by the way, I represent UAF in my district. I'm wearing my blue and gold today. I have 2 degrees from the University of Alaska from different campuses. But to the comment of, you know, if they could do this, they would have done it already. It has taken years for the university system to make transferring credits between campuses fully functional. And there are still challenges to doing so. And the university has worked incredibly hard to make that system better. But still, for a long time, something that seemed very common sense and something that would have dramatically improved the student experience did not happen. It did not happen quickly, and it did not happen easily. And I experienced that as a student myself. So I do think there's a lot of value in saying, we want this to happen. We want this to happen in a uniform way and in a timely way. And this is a really good time to bring this legislation forward because of the OIT upgrades that the university system is going through. I also just want to address the potential for legal challenges and just make note that in the legislation, we have in Section 2 the line that this is to be done to the extent practicable. I think that's an incredibly important caveat to this, because we're not saying that the university needs to publish specific textbook prices, $100 versus $105, for example. We're simply saying the university needs to the best of its ability and to the greatest extent practicable, offer an option for students to search in UA Online for low and no cost resource classes. And again, that's not by a specific price, and it's to the extent practicable. So in the scenario that Representative McKay mentioned, where maybe a textbook that the instructor knows costs $100, and maybe later it costs $300. First of all, that particular scenario wouldn't in any way be affected by this bill because there wouldn't be a low-cost resource used in that situation to begin with. But let's say the text was $20 and it raised to $100, so a more realistic scenario. It would still be practicable for the university to advertise that text as a low-cost resource. Again, the goal is not to create a situation where there's absolutely no flexibility or it's 100% every single cost is outlined. We're just trying to give students a much better picture of what to expect when they register. And if there are legal challenges with this legislation, then the university will encounter them as they work to implement something similar regardless. And I would just note one other thing, which is that why should the legislature kind of weigh in? I just want to note that by defining what a low-cost resource is at the legislative level, we're not creating a situation where the Board of Regents says, let's say in 10 years, you know what, I think a low-cost resource now is actually anything under $200, for example. Well, the Board of Regents may feel that that's a low-cost resource, and perhaps it is. I would argue that by setting a definition for low-cost resource that has the ability to sort of adapt over time by being the resource that costs not more than four times the minimum wage, we're allowing for that to adjust over time, and we're defining what a low-cost resource is. So we're avoiding a situation where the perception of a low-cost resource for the administration dramatically differs from the perception of a low-cost resource for a student. Hopefully that answers a few of the questions that have arisen.
Thank you, Representative Carrick. Representative Himshaw.
Sorry, one last follow-up, please, through the chair. Where else is this done? Are there examples of other university systems doing this?
Thank you, through the chair, to Representative Himshaw. There are actually five university systems which have something similar. The legislation in House Bill 10 is very similar to what was recently passed in Maryland. And if you'll give me one second. The other four states which have adopted substantially similar legislation are Washington, Texas, Oregon, and Louisiana.
Thank you, Representative Carrick. Representative Prox.
Thank you. Through the chair to Ms. Perrin. Is it possible to get a somewhat accurate estimate of the cost of implementing this? The reason I ask is the other, I can't even remember the name of the bill, but the Department of Revenue gave us an estimate for simply providing a checkbox on a PFD application form, and it was over 100,000. Kind of floored me. And if their estimate is reasonable, it would seem to me that this is a much more complicated project and it would cost considerably more. And we wouldn't want to obligate the university to do that, to put a ridiculous point on it, but I'm not sure that this is ridiculous. $500,000. And I don't know one way or the other. Somebody has to let us know how much it's going to cost.
Through the chair to Representative Prox, we can pull numbers of that certainly. Where I will try right now to walk you through is that last year when we heard this bill, prior to the legislature giving university the appropriation to upgrade our information students piece, our UA Online and Banner, we had this as a substantial fiscal note, and among that being $397,000 just for the contractor hours to redevelop the ability to show the course materials within that. We stand by the fact that $397,000 has now been absorbed into our larger upgrade that we are already implementing. We have a team that's working on an RFP right now that will go out to contractors to bid, and they will take that component as well as many other pieces into our overall larger bid. But there is certainly still that specific time that will be required of those contractors to build that out. Separately, anticipate a few hours per faculty for each course that they're going to be sending, you know, linking their materials up. However, they are already a set cost based on the fact that we're, you know, salaried, et cetera. So it is not potentially an additional hourly cost for that. But we'll happily bring back some numbers for you of what we anticipate the hours to look like on that.
Okay, just a quick follow-up through the chair. That won't interfere with your ongoing contracting process. If it does, obviously I would wait.
Through the chair, just to clarify, you mean getting the numbers won't interfere? Is that?
I don't know. The bidding process, if you're providing more information than you want to for the bidding, obviously we wouldn't want to do that.
Through the chair, to represent props, I actually think that is quite appropriate. And yes, we to put those numbers out would have some impact on the RFP.
Sure. So. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Prox. So I did have a couple of comments myself. So I've had the opportunity to be an adjunct faculty member at the university for a number of years. And I was always providing the textbook that was going to be used in the class that I taught for the fall semester in the springtime. But I was always fascinated by how many students enrolled in my class that had no idea what the textbook was going to be until they started the class. It seems to me that from the testimony, the invited testimony that we heard, that a bigger issue is the fact that students are maybe not aware of what the textbook is clearly when they sign up for a class. Is that something that you can speak to as to why there seems to be a disconnect between those things?
Through the chair, to the chair, co-chair at Refuge. Boy, this is a little bit of a mental game here. And I am not a student so I can't say what the deliberation is currently. However, I think that it may be because it is a multiple step process. You go on to UA Online and you can see the course. At UAF, there is then a link which takes you to the bookstore, which is where you can see the available materials that are currently assigned to that. And I would surmise that extra step may be a barrier, and also that extra step isn't available currently with all three of our universities.
Okay, thank you. Other questions, comments? Representative Storm?
Thank you, Co-Chair Ruffridge. My comment is I see that the bill sponsor from the other body is in the room, and I just thought we might be good to hear from him if he wanted to about anything that we've been discussing today.
Thank you, Representative Story. I will leave that up to our House sponsor to decide on that.
If the committee would like to have the Senate companion sponsor come up, I am perfectly happy for that as well.
Okay, thank you, Representative Carrick. Does anyone have any questions for our other body member, Senator Myers? All right, seeing none. Any other questions for Representative Carrick? Also seeing none. All right. Well, thank you very much for the presentation on House Bill 10. Thank you to our invited testifiers. Thank you for being here to answer questions in the room. And then we will set this bill aside for another hearing at a later date. Is there anything else for the good of the order before we adjourn? The record, Representative McKay, we are getting out on time today, early even. All right, seeing no other business before us, this concludes the House Education Committee meeting on March 20th, and we will be adjourned at 9:51 a.m.